From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. Her new memoir, Living History, was published this week and became an immediate bestseller. It covers her childhood, her life as First Lady and Senator, as well as some of the territory that she had previously declined to discuss about her marriage and Monica Lewinsky. Also, we remember David Brinkley, the former NBC News anchor, died last night at the age of 82. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Republican-run House has approved legislation expanding eligibility for increased child tax credits to both lower and upper-income families. NPR's David Wilner reports from the Capitol.
Despite having earlier shown little enthusiasm for including low-income families that don't pay income taxes in the increased child tax credit, House Majority Leader Tom DeLay hailed the $82 billion bill that does just that.
The American people will see that the Republican Party believes in helping families through the child tax credit, and the Democrat Party doesn't.
But House Democrats said the legislation would be difficult to reconcile with a much smaller tax bill passed by the Senate, which is paid for with increased revenues, unlike the House bill. They also chided GOP leaders for leaving out a provision that would have made refunds available in the next few months rather than next year. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
The head of U.S. ground forces in Iraq says the country will remain a combat zone for some time. Army Lieutenant General David McKiernan made the comment on the third day of the largest U.S. military operation since the fall of Saddam Hussein 2 months ago. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer said the continued deadly attacks on U.S. forces are being staged by organized groups of 5 to 10 men with strong ties to the fallen Ba'ath Party regime of Saddam Hussein. Bremer, who spoke by video phone from Baghdad, said so far there's no hard evidence they're being directed by a central command structure.
They may be colleagues from the Ba'ath movement. They could be several people from the Fedayeen Saddam or from the Republican Guards. But we do not at the moment see evidence of central command and control of these groups. I certainly wouldn't exclude it, but we don't have the evidence yet.
Bremer also said former Saddam loyalists are spreading rumors that the deposed dictator is ready to make a comeback, rumors Bremer called pure political sabotage. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Washington.
Newsman David Brinkley has died. He was 82. NPR's Cokie Roberts recalls his influence as co-anchor with Chet Huntley of the popular NBC television news program, The Huntley-Brinkley Report.
What's important to keep in mind is how crucial it was to have the Southern voice of David Brinkley covering civil rights. Southerners like me grew up hearing that the problem was just Yankees, outside agitators. And David Brinkley made it clear that he was from the South and civil rights was an issue that Southerners should be concerned about.
NPR's Cokie Roberts worked with David Brinkley for almost 10 years on the ABC program This Week with David Brinkley. Brinkley died of complications from a fall. The Dow gained 13 points to close at 91.96. This is NPR News. The effort to recall California Governor Gray Davis appears to be gaining momentum as a new poll shows that almost half of California voters favor his removal from office. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The poll by the nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California shows that 48% of those surveyed would vote to turn Davis out of the governor's chair. And among those considered most likely to vote, 51% support the recall, while 43% still support Davis. The move to recall the Democratic incumbent began not long after he defeated Republican challenger Bill Simon in last year's election. Davis has been criticized for his cautious reaction to the state's energy crisis, and critics blame him for this year's looming $38 billion budget deficit. Davis's supporters have begun a campaign to fight the recall movement. They say the move is highly partisan. But the poll also shows that 75% of likely voters disapprove of Davis's job performance. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.
A California company has pleaded guilty to covering up malfunctions in a heart surgery device that may have led to at least a dozen deaths. Endovascular Technologies pleaded guilty to 10 felonies and agreed to pay more than $92 million in penalties involving its AnCure stent graft device, which is used during heart surgeries to treat heart aneurysms. Federal prosecutors charged that the device often failed to work and said that the company asked surgeons to use it in ways that weren't approved by the government. The problems were resolved after the company voluntarily recalled the device and reintroduced it in 2001. In stocks, the Nasdaq gained 7 points today to close at 1653. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from White Wave, makers of Silk, organic soy milk available in handcrafted lattes in neighborhood Starbucks. Silk is soy.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton has a new memoir that was published this week and became an immediate bestseller. It's called Living History, and as you probably know by now, she writes about her childhood, her marriage to Bill Clinton, and her life as First Lady and Senator from New York. The book also covers some of the territory she had previously kept off limits surrounding the Monica Lewinsky scandal. I recorded an interview with Senator Clinton yesterday. Senator Clinton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
When your husband was the president, he was attacked by what you described as the vast right-wing conspiracy. He was impeached by the House. He was investigated by the special prosecutor. Many spectators emerged from all of that disgusted with politics. But you entered politics after this, running for Senate. Why did you want to get deeper into politics after everything that you saw happen to your husband?
I think that's obviously a really good question. And I thought about it a lot because many of my friends and close colleagues urged me, you know, not to run for office, not to even put my foot into this environment, which was so toxic. And the politics of personal destruction were the unfortunate consequence of the very partisan battles that were being waged. But I took a very hard look at what I thought was happening below the surface, that these very difficult conflicts over the direction of the country were ones that bothered me greatly, because I knew that despite the mistakes I made, and certainly acknowledge in this book, and the problems that my husband and I had, which are part of history, unfortunately, there was something else at work. And what was at work were two competing visions of where our country should go. And I believe that it's worth fighting for those values that I grew up with, that I thought America represented, and that I thought that my husband and I at least tried to further and stand for. So it was not an easy decision. But after I'd been through the gauntlet and been accused of everything you can imagine and really come out of it still standing, I thought, you know, if I walk away, if I say, you know, I don't want to be involved in politics, then I'm really actually conceding a victory to those whom I oppose so strongly. And I guess finally, I would say that, you know, one thing that always bothered me during the time in the White House and still to this day is that it really does matter what the political decisions are in terms of how the rules of the game are set and whether everybody in this country feels that he or she has a fair shot and a chance to, you know, live out that American dream. And I see the odds increasingly stacked against the average American. You know, we hear about huge tax cuts. We hear about environmental regulations rolled back. We hear about all of the issues that families and people talk to me about. But what is not covered as well, what is not understood, is that there's a very concerted effort with a right-wing agenda to turn the clock back on America. And the administration in Washington today is one of the most radical and reactionary, albeit with, you know, a lot of nice rhetoric that we've ever had in American history.
Senator Clinton, you were a kind of symbol of evil for the right when you were the First Lady. But I think that you are being less demonized now that you're actually in office as a senator from New York, do you agree that you were more demonized as First Lady than as senator? And if so, why do you think that that's true?
Well, I think that it really is rooted in, I'm sure some people symbolically being bothered or worried about what I represented, apart from who I am as a person. And I also concede that, you know, obviously I'm not everyone's cup of tea. You know, I'm very outspoken. I work for what I believe in. I stand up to people in ways that I think
But you're
help
trying to
make
do that
point.
As a senator, not just as a First Lady. What's the difference in how you're perceived?
Well, but I think, you know, the First Lady role is such a unique symbolic role, and it stands for so many things that the woman herself has, you know, only passing reference to. It is a generational symbol, a historic symbol, a concept of womanhood, of all of that rolled up into one person, which is why it's always been a rather challenging role for me and my predecessors, and we've each tried to do the best we can in our own ways. But now I've got a real job. It's a job that comes with responsibilities and obligations to the people I represent. I get up every day and try to figure out how I'm going to improve life for New Yorkers. I work with my colleagues on both sides of the aisle because there are coalitions that I can help to form around issues that I think matter to New York and America. So it's me acting on my own, less symbolically than substantively. People can agree or disagree with the votes I cast or the speeches I make on the Senate floor, but I'm not carrying this enormous weight of expectations that you never can meet, and that certainly become even more of a flashpoint when you have a president who is breaking down barriers and trying to move the country in a progressive direction.
Do you think it's also that your job as senator doesn't depend on your marriage to Bill Clinton? It's not about the marriage. It's not about him. It's about you.
Oh, I think that's a big part of it. You know, first ladies are kept at a distance, and they are part of this enormous apparatus around a president. After all, the only reason I or anybody was in the White House during Bill Clinton's administration is because he in some way selected us to get married, but everyone else invited to work in the White House. So the president is the overwhelming figure of importance. There isn't any staff person or first lady or anyone else who can claim anything but derivative authority from the president. Well, senators get to speak for themselves and their constituents. And that was one of the transitions that I had to make from a political helpmate, a first lady, to a senator, speaking on my own, speaking on behalf of my constituents. But the final point about that, Terry, which I know it's difficult to really articulate, at least for me, because it's kind of in the realm of history and symbolism and myth almost, is that when you're in one of these roles that are really, as I say in the book, a kind of Rorschach test for other people's marriages, for their aspirations, for their views on politics, for their economic hopes and dreams. I mean, it's all rolled up into quite a complex jumble, and there's no way, at least from my perspective, to totally unpack it. I think we can't separate out that what Bill and I stood for politically was at the root of the extreme partisanship and opposition. You know, they could have just said, look, you know, she's a baby boomer generation first lady. We don't like her. But that wasn't the nature of the attacks. It was, look what they're trying to do to health care. Look, they're trying to take your guns away. Look what they're trying to do to the environment. Look at this. Look at that. And so it became, the personal became the political. And it's very hard when I, even to this day, see fundraising letters sent out about, stop me, stop me. You know, it's not just me as a person. It's the political point of view, it's the values, it's the vision of America I have that they consider so threatening.
Your opponents on the right were very skilled at attacking your husband's presidency, attacking your health care campaign, attacking your marriage and your private life. The Democrats now are having a very hard time in forcefully opposing President Bush and his policies, particularly the tax cut, this unprecedentedly large tax cut at a time of war with Iraq, facing, you know, the expenses of war, facing the expenses of the occupation. Democrats who are critical of how the Democrats are handling President Bush now say that the Democrats aren't being forceful enough in their opposition. I mean, critics are saying the Democrats are just afraid to really stand up. They want to be perceived as centrist in the hope that that will help them win the next round of elections. What do you say to those critics who think that the Democrats just aren't doing a good enough job right now?
Well, I understand a lot of the frustration, and I would say several things, as I do to friends and constituents who raise this issue with me. There's a very big bully pulpit in the White House. I know that probably as well as anyone because I was there for 8 years watching it in action. So we close ranks. We support our president. Elections are times to, you know, really decide whether we want someone to continue or not. And certainly in the atmosphere in which we find ourselves after September 11th, that is even more true. And I understand that and accept it. Secondly, I think there is a fundamental difference, which I came to perceive during the 8 years in the White House, which I do talk about in the book. And that is that, you know, Democrats really traditionally are more into the business of governing for the betterment of people that they believe we represent. So that it really matters to us, you know, what the details are when you argue about the Medicare prescription drug benefit or when you worry about whether the clock's going to be rolled back on environmental regulations. And I have really come to see how the Republicans are so much more adept at and understanding of power, and therefore their take on most political conflict is, what do we have to do to win? Now, you can say from a perspective at some distance, well, gee, you know, that's a gross generalization, no pun on your name, Terry, but, you know, that's a very broad, sweeping statement. And of course it is, and it's not true in every case. But in general, I think there is some real truth to it. And therefore, it is harder often for Democrats to explain where they stand. Are you for or against a tax cut? Well, you know, we're against unreasonable, unaffordable, irresponsible tax cuts, but we would like tax cuts that help the middle class, that target investment, that create jobs, etc. Whereas, you know, that message takes a lot longer to say than we're for tax cuts, end of sentence. Whatever they are, as big as they are, we're for them. There's another element to this, though, and I think that I, again, have firsthand experience with it. The Republican Party, the conservative wing of the Republican Party, has literally been on a mission for probably 40 years to turn the clock back on things that they disapprove of, whether it was, you know, going back to the Great Depression and the creation of Social Security, or in the 40s, the expansion of unions and worker rights, or in the 50s and 60s, you know, the government intervening in civil rights. You just pick a subject where there's been sweeping change, I believe, on balance for the better for America. There has been a hard core of right-wing conservative Republicans that have built their influence day after day, and I give them credit for this. I mean, I think it is a tremendous accomplishment that they have taken what used to be in the extremes in our political philosophy and moved it into acceptable territory. And they, of course, were disappointed, which now has been written about widely when Barry Goldwater was so badly beaten, but it didn't stop them. They came together, they endowed professorships, they started think tanks, they began to really work to make their worldview the American mainstream worldview. So when Bill Clinton was elected, that was an abrupt interruption in their entitlement to power. For the last 24 years, there'd only been one Democratic president's term, and that was Jimmy Carter for 4 years. And from talking with people who are quite proud of their accomplishments in changing the political landscape in America, they viewed my husband as a tremendous threat, not just because he won the presidency, but that he did actually speak for the majority of Americans who wanted fiscal responsibility combined with safety nets and combined with investments and combined with opportunities for people to be more responsible for themselves and also for our country, to have a different face in the world, more leading from our values and our leadership qualities as opposed to just our military strength, which is obviously unmatched.
My guest is Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. She's written a new memoir called Living History. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Senator Hillary Clinton. She has a new memoir, as I'm sure you know, called Living History. Where do you see the Bush administration, and President Bush in particular, in terms of what you described during your husband's presidency as the vast right-wing conspiracy? Do you see anyone in the Bush administration, including the president himself, as fitting into that group or as furthering that style of politics?
Absolutely. And, of course, in the book I say that the word conspiracy was probably not a very accurate description because there's nothing secret any longer about this. You know, they're not meeting in you know, behind closed doors. You know, they do things in secret, like the so-called Arkansas Project and the like. But by and large, this is a very open agenda that is well-financed and well-organized. And I think this administration, with the people who are in it, whose views on both foreign policy issues and domestic issues are so extreme and radical, are very much the ultimate victory in some respects for those who have been speaking out against school desegregation and public education and a woman's right to choose and protecting the environment against the ravages of unchecked development and pollution. And you go down the line, and I think that the great untold story of this administration, which the media is certainly not paying attention to, is how what used to be considered so radical has been put into a new suit of clothes with a very nice smile and nice words like compassion. But I don't think that this administration in reality is either compassionate or conservative. It is hard-edged, radical, right-wing with a very specific view of where they want to take America.
Do you ever look at some of the people who are or have been your political opponents and who criticized you or your husband for personal reasons, for your way of life, for your stand on women's issues, for his affairs or whatever, and look at them and think, you're a hypocrite. I know something about your personal life that isn't public. Do you ever think thoughts like that? And would you ever want to see somebody's personal life exposed if you thought they were being a hypocrite?
Well, no, I really don't. I think we should draw a line there. But in the book, I write about a few of these people, and you know, I say that I certainly can sympathize with their outrage at having their public problems aired in the light of day, but it was stunning to me the double standard they were operating under. But you see, from their perspective, they are on the side of all that is right and good and important and significant, and that's a political judgment they make, that, you know, the ends do justify the means if you're taking away a woman's right to choose. The ends are okay if the ultimate objective is to eventually, over time, dismantle the Medicaid program because you're going to block grant it and cut the resources that are going to guarantee health care for children and people in nursing homes. And those kinds of issues are really their primary focus. So they excuse an enormous amount of personal issues on their side of the ledger, which they do on a daily basis. I'm very well aware of that, because they're all part of this overall mission to take back America. You know, there's this group called the Federalist Society, which has been around for a while and which vets every single judicial nominee for the Bush administration. If you're not okayed by the Federalist Society with their very conservative non-mainstream judicial philosophy, you don't get nominated by this White House. And so the result is we have people being nominated who are incredible in the values and the attitudes that they bring to the bench. But this Federalist Society has for years now talked about bringing the Constitution back from exile. Now, when did the Constitution, in their view, go into exile? It went into exile when the Supreme Court under Earl Warren rendered the decision in Brown v. Board of Education. Now, I happen to think that was one of the most significant points in American history, not just judicial history, but every bit of our history, because it moved us one step closer toward tearing down the walls of segregation and trying to create a truly integrated society, as difficult as that is. But these are people who really do want to turn the clock back. I used to think that they were interested only in turning the clock back on the Clinton administration, but honest to goodness, they're on their way to trying to undo Franklin Roosevelt, and I think they're going to, you know, be closing in on Teddy Roosevelt pretty soon.
Senator Hillary Clinton, her new memoir is called Living History. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback The Emperor of Ocean Park by Stephen Carter. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Senator Hillary Clinton, and we listen back to an interview with David Brinkley. The former NBC News anchor died last night at the age of 82. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Senator Hillary Clinton. Her new memoir, Living History, was published this week. In the book, she reveals some of her reactions to learning that her husband had lied to her and the American public about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. Senator, I know that you think that your husband's affair with Monica Lewinsky was very personally damaging to your marriage and not a good thing to do, but you didn't think it was an impeachable offense. Do you think that presidents should be judged at all on that aspect of their private lives?
Well, Terry, you know, I had this rather unique experience of working on the impeachment staff in 1974 when Richard Nixon was impeached. I was just fresh out of law school, a young lawyer. I worked with Republican and Democratic lawyers, members of the committee who were so careful and literally nonpartisan. It wasn't just bipartisan. They knew that this was an awesome undertaking. And one of my tasks was to research the legal and historical precedent behind the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors, which appears in the Constitution when it talks about impeachment. And I have no doubt that it was not personal matters that our founders and those who were making the decisions about our Constitution had in mind. They were focused on those kinds of actions and behaviors that would affect the public performance. In fact, you know, there was a big debate.
But should it be judged at all by individuals? How do you think?
Of course, anything is going to affect how individuals feel about another individual, whether that person's, you know, in the White House or in any other walk of life. But when you see the political process being perverted and the Constitution subverted for partisan purposes in what was an unprecedented attempt to grab power away from a lawfully elected president using his personal failings, which he's admitted, which were horrible for my family and which just caused me incredible pain and distress, but to use that for a partisan political purpose was very dangerous to our system of government and to our Constitution. Now, luckily, the American people got it right, as they often do. They saw through it. They understood what this was about and in huge numbers stood behind the president. And despite the fact that the House Republicans had the votes to go ahead and impeach him, you know, that didn't in any way affect the senators who didn't even give a majority vote to any of these charges.
Because
thankfully, it worked out. But look what it put the country through. I find that just even now reflecting back hard to understand.
Because the president risked so much personally and politically by having the affair with Monica Lewinsky, and because there's been speculation about other affairs, there's been a lot of people who have thought that he must have some kind of sexual addiction or compulsion. Do you think that he does?
Oh, Terry, I think I've gone as far as I would go in my book, which is a whole lot farther than I ever thought I would in terms of talking about, you know, very private personal matters. And I have to say that many people in interviews over the last several days have said, well, you know, you're supposed to be such a private person. Why did you even write about this? And of course, I wished it hadn't been made public. I wished our situation could have stayed within our family in the counseling that we did have, but it wasn't. It was forced into the public by people who could have cared less about me or my daughter or my mother or Bill's family or anything else. It was for a malicious purpose, and I am just going to let my book speak for itself.
What crossed your mind when you heard from the new Robert Dallek biography of JFK that JFK actually had an affair with an intern?
You know, I guess maybe I read enough history growing up and have been involved in politics for long enough to know that we don't have any saints in public office. We don't have any perfect human beings. The performance of a president and his leadership on behalf of our country is really for Americans themselves to judge and for history to judge. I think my husband will be judged very favorably by history because I think he did a good job for our country. I think when he left office, we were well prepared for the future. And as to other presidents, I think the same standard should apply. There are, you know, many people who, it's human nature, I understand that, want to know what happened behind closed doors, who did what to whom. I don't think there's any direct correlation between a president's private behavior and his public leadership. So I think we'll just leave that for the historians to sort out.
I know you're on a very tight schedule, so I'll just ask you one more question. You've worked with Tom DeLay and Lindsey Graham on legislation. And, I mean, these are people who really opposed her husband during the impeachment era. Is working with them an exercise for you in swallowing poison or an exercise in just, like, finding the common ground?
It's an exercise in doing my job. It's an exercise in building coalitions and consensus around issues that I think are important and that matter to the people I represent. And I also really do believe that there is more than ample ground on which we can disagree and be absolutely adamant in what we think is right for the country politically. But I don't think that we want to continue the politics of personal destruction. I'm frankly more concerned right now with what I see as the politics of economic destruction being propagated by the administration and the Republican Party. I'm going to take them on that issue. I don't have any need to try to undermine them personally, try to demonize them. I'm going to take Tom DeLay on over the child care tax credit, which he is adamantly opposed, which we passed to remedy a grave injustice in the Senate last week. And I'll take any of my other colleagues on when it comes to important issues. But when we can find common ground, you know, maybe I can try to demonstrate that that's the more appropriate way for us to engage in our political differences, by working together whenever we can, and by standing strongly but not personally, destructively against one another when we have serious differences.
Senator Clinton, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, I enjoyed it. I hope we'll get a chance to talk again sometime.
Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, her new memoir is called Living History. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with former TV news anchor David Brinkley. He died last night at the age of 82. This is Fresh Air. David Brinkley died at his home last night of complications from a fall. He was 82. He spent about half a century in the news business. In fact, as he pointed out, he started doing TV news before anyone was watching. And when he stopped anchoring in 1979, he said that he'd done the news longer than anyone else on earth. Brinkley started his broadcasting career at NBC in 1943. In 1956, he was paired with Chet Huntley to cover the Democratic and Republican conventions for NBC. They worked so well together, they became the anchors of the NBC Evening News, which was given the name the Huntley-Brinkley Report. After Chet Huntley retired in 1970, Brinkley co-anchored the NBC News with John Chancellor and then became a commentator. In 1981, he joined ABC, where he began the Sunday morning program This Week with David Brinkley. He stepped down from hosting the program in 1996, remained on the program as a commentator, then retired in 1997. When I spoke with him in 1989, after the publication of his book Washington Goes to War, we talked about the start of his broadcasting career.
Now, you were the White House correspondent, weren't you, for, was it NBC Radio?
NBC, well, that's, radio was all it was then.
Right, okay. So, listen, I figure it must have not been considered a very important beat if such a young man or someone still really a rookie was assigned to the White House in the
40s. Well, partly because I got out of the Army early, and everybody was crying for male help. Female help was not as welcome then as it is now. All kinds of changes have taken place. And the White House was not really a full-time beat. The president had press conferences twice a week, one on Tuesday morning and one on Thursday afternoon. I may have those reversed, because they were intended only for newspapers. And a reporter showed up at the appointed hour, went to the press conference, and left. And there were only five or six who were there all day, and there was no reason to be there all day because not much was happening. There was no such thing as a leak at that time.
You point out that radio became a medium that was taken seriously as a news medium during World War II. Did you take radio very seriously when you were working in it? Did you think of it as the place you wanted to continue to work
And again, this was before television.
I did take it very seriously. I thought it was terribly important. During the war, more than ever before, people stayed glued to the radios because we had tremendous amounts of news. And I remember putting on all kinds of things during the war that the newspapers would not have until the next morning. And there were people all over the country who kept the radio on all day long and had a map. And they put pins in the map to keep track of activity on the war fronts as the radio reported them. And we had some very, very good reporters in those days reporting the war from the war fronts. I never did that. And so radio became a very serious and highly respected news medium.
Now, I learned from your new book that NBC used to insist that after 6 in the evening, men had to wear formal attire and black tie. How long did that regulation last, and what was the rationale for it?
Well, the rationale was that NBC wanted to be considered what it was for a long time, the foremost radio network. It was a serious enterprise. Everything on the air was live. Everything. There was not even a recorded commercial. Everything was live. And they wanted to maintain a high degree of dignity and seriousness and public acceptance. And so in the photographs of radio performers at night, Fred Allen, big names in those years, all wore black tie. The announcers wore black tie. Everyone wore black tie.
Of course, no one listening to the radio could see them.
I know that. But,
yes, I figured you'd know that, yeah.
Somehow it had an effect on they thought it had an effect on the performance of their people.
Did you buy that yourself?
Well, I don't know. I didn't own the network, and if that's what they wanted, it was okay with me. It didn't matter.
Did you have to keep a change of clothes with you, so if you had a report after 6, you'd have your formal attire?
Yes. Yes. They stopped that eventually. I don't remember exactly what year they stopped it, but they did stop it. I think when television came along, they dropped it.
Now, was that sense of formality carried over into The Voice as well? Were you expected to sound very formal, especially in the evening hours?
Well, people in radio at that time took their diction and their speech patterns very, very seriously. I remember announcers saying in tones of awe, that, what's his name, I used to announce a Metropolitan Radio, a Metropolitan Opera broadcast, Milton Cross? Was he Milton
yeah,
Cross?
Yeah,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
Milton Cross. They spoke of him as if he were some kind of deity because he had won a prize for having the finest diction in radio. And it was good.
Now, you really have perhaps the most consciously or unconsciously imitated voice in broadcasting. When did you first become aware that other people in broadcasting were picking up your inflections?
I guess the first time was when somebody ran an ad in Variety, the little show business newspaper, weekly newspaper, ran an ad in Variety offering $1,500 for somebody who could record a commercial for 1 minute using my speech pattern. And the joke at the time was that I applied for it and was turned down, which is, of course, not true, but that was the joke. I don't know anymore. I shouldn't tell this because I don't know what finally happened.
Well, while we're talking about your voice, let's talk a little bit about writing. You've been praised so much for knowing how to write a simple declarative sentence and for writing really clear, concise copy for television. How did you develop your style of writing for radio and TV?
Well, I worked for United Press, which at that time had what it called a radio wire. I guess it still has it. It goes only to radio stations, and they thought I could write well, so they put me to work writing for the radio wire. And it attracted some attention because it was pretty good, I guess, and NBC hired me as a writer to write news scripts for announcers to read, which is how the news was done then. And one reason I learned to write clearly and simply was that I had to write in such a way that the announcers, who knew nothing of what they were reading, that the announcers could not read it wrongly. And so they would emphasize the right word and not change the meaning of the sentence by emphasizing a wrong word.
Would you ever let anyone write for you? Did anyone ever write for you in your years of anchoring?
No.
Did you ever try it and have a bad experience?
No. Well, a time or two, for whatever reason, I had to read something because something happened while I was on the air. I had to read copy written by someone else, and I found I simply could not do it. I can't do it.
When you say you cannot say it, does that mean that you trip over the words?
It means that I gobble it all up. So what I have, what I've always had to do, this hadn't happened much. When it did happen, I first had to read it and then ad-lib it.
Uh-huh.
I can't read other people's copy.
Does that have to do more with not liking other people's writing or more with needing sentences that fit your inflections?
The second, needing sentences that fit my inflections. I can't read other people's sentences. I simply can't.
Mm-hmm. You've said that you learned to do TV before anyone was watching, and I guess that's pretty true. And by 1950, you were doing regular reports on the, what was it called, the Camel News Caravan?
John Cameron Swayze and the Camel News Caravan. It was perfectly awful, Terry.
Why was it awful?
Well, partly because when one set out to do a television news program at that time, there was no history to go by. No one knew how to do it. It had never been done before. And you are not old enough to remember, but in the past, there were, in the movie theaters, newsreels between the features. And they were perfectly awful. They were owned by the movie studios, and mainly they used them to clear out the theater between features so people wouldn't sit through them twice. And there were dull, boring, silly stories about ship launchings, horse races, fashion shows, and so on. So when television came along and decided to do news, they didn't know what to do except to copy the newsreels, which is what they did. And the Swayze program, which I did do a little bit of, was, as I say, perfectly awful. It was ship launchings and fashion shows and other kinds of junk. No news, really. Not much.
Well, this was before there were rules about what made good television, and I would think that that would leave you free to take certain risks and experiment a little.
Free to, but not really able to, because the facilities were so bad. The film was black and white. The sound was optical sound, very poor. It took forever to get film processed, and forever beyond that to get it edited. When it came from out of the city, New York or Washington, it had to be flown in and very often got lost at the airport. It was really a mess. So all we did was struggle and try to get something on the air, and that's about all we accomplished.
Well, in 1956, you became the co-anchor of the NBC News with Chet Huntley,
mm-hmm.
the Huntley-Brinkley Report. Was anchoring at that time considered a real high-prestige position in the way that it's subsequently been seen?
Nothing like it has come to be since then. It was then thought of as a kind of interesting job. There weren't any real anchors before that. There was John Cameron Swayze, and on CBS along later came Doug Edwards. And on ABC, I don't think they were in the game yet. So there wasn't much. Anchoring didn't amount to much. There wasn't much to anchor. The programs are 15 minutes long. The pictures are bad. The sound was bad. Very few people had television sets. And so it didn't really amount to much. It later came to be what it is. Whatever that is, I'm not sure I know.
Do you mind me asking a question? I know you've been asked
ask
a million
any question,
times.
I don't care what it
but
is.
About how you were paired with Chet Huntley.
NBC thought at that time, the biggest name in news at that time prior to that was Ed Murrow. And every network felt it had to have an Ed Murrow or somebody who sounded like him. NBC hired Chet Huntley thinking he sounded like Ed Murrow. And he was in New York and I was in Washington. For the first time they'd resolved to cover a political convention thoroughly, because finally we had some cameras and so on, were able to do it. And they were unwilling to trust either of us alone, and so they put the two of us together, thinking that if one of us screwed up, the other could save him. There have been many arguments about who was responsible for that decision, but somebody in New York made it, and we did do the 1956 convention together. And it worked very well, and it led to the Huntley-Brinkley news report in fall of 56.
Now, I understand that you really didn't like the famous sign-off that you used every night.
I didn't.
Good night, Chet. Good night, David. Why not? It doesn't seem very offensive.
Well, it seemed silly to me. It seemed that when we said good night, we should say good night to the audience. We are there to tell them the news, not to tell each other. We're there. And I didn't think it sounded too good, two men saying good night to each other on the air. We should say good night to the audience. And I fought and argued and fought and argued and lost. The producer insisted that we say goodnight, Chet, and goodnight, David. So finally we gave in, and we did, and it became, for a long time, part of the language.
Since it caught on, do you think that you were wrong, or do you think that you were right?
Well, I don't know. Who's to say? But yeah. It caught on, and so I couldn't argue anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were first paired to cover a convention together, and you've said that you have always really liked covering conventions. You've thought of them as kind of big parties, big games, a lot of excitement. I was wondering what you felt at the Chicago convention. In the Democratic Convention in 1968.
68?
Yeah.
I felt I was in a foreign country. I was shocked by what was happening out there in the streets. Students being beaten by the police. The mayor of Chicago turning out the sewer workers to fill up the auditorium to cheer him and to hold up signs saying, "We love Mayor Daley." It truly was shocking and somewhat frightening. I remember that was at about the time when the Russians had gone into Czechoslovakia to shut down the democratic movement there under Dubček. And I remember saying on the air, "Are we in the United States or are we in Czechoslovakia?" Well, the mayor, needless to say, didn't like that, but it was true. I was shocked by it and infuriated by it.
Now, did you get any flack for saying that? Are we in the United States or are we in Czechoslovakia?
I got some flack from Mayor Daley, but not much from anybody else. I think everybody else outside of Chicago was shocked at what happened there.
We're listening back to a 1989 interview with David Brinkley. He died last night at the age of 82. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. TV news anchor and commentator David Brinkley died last night at the age of 82. We're listening back to an interview I recorded with him in 1989. I asked him about his Sunday morning program This Week with David Brinkley, in which he and ABC reporter Sam Donaldson analyzed and gave opinions on news stories. I asked if it had become more acceptable on TV to allow newsmen to state opinions on the air.
Obviously, when Sam is on the air with me and George and whoever else on Sunday mornings, he is not giving the news. We are having a discussion. We're not saying what happened. We're saying what we think about what happened, and it is clearly labeled. No one is deceived by it. Nevertheless, there are people who think reporters, people who report news in an objective, though I don't like that word, fashion, should not sometime later on the same station, same channel, be giving his opinions. And as I say, I can't really satisfy myself on that point. I still have questions about it.
Let me ask you this. The two people who I assume are supposed to be political balance to each other are George Will as the conservative and Sam Donaldson as the liberal, but it always seems to me that George Will is further to the right than Sam Donaldson is to the left. And I was wondering if you think of them as an equal balance.
I don't really think of it in those terms, Terry. I don't think political opinion can be measured by some kind of micrometer. What you say may well be true, but if asked to prove it, I would have a hard time doing it. George is quite conservative, and Sam is sort of liberal. He's not a red-hot, screaming left-winger, but he's sort of liberal. And he very often disagrees with George, and I'm delighted. Otherwise, we would miss a lot of chances for opinions to be exposed and discussed because everybody agreed. It'd make a fairly boring program, actually.
Where do you think of yourself as falling in the political spectrum?
I have spent my entire working life avoiding any political label.
Mm-hmm.
The only answer I can give you is that depending on what it is, I am either a liberal or a conservative. That's no answer, I know, but I can't give you an answer. It depends on what the question is.
Mm-hmm. When people come on your show on Sunday morning, I'm sure they come on determined to just say what it is that they've decided to say beforehand. And then it's your job and the jobs of the other people on the show to try to get them to go beyond what they've prepared in advance. Is that very difficult to do? And do you think of yourself or as the other people on the program as having certain techniques of pushing people further than they planned to go?
Yes. Everything you say is true. Everyone we have on the air, usually it's some sort of political figure or an academic figure or some sort of intellectual figure. Every one of them will arrive in a studio with some little sermonette in mind and determined to deliver it. So one thing I do is first ask them a dull, boring question like, what do you think about this? And let them deliver their little sermonette. And then we get to the hardcore of what we're there to talk about. Let them get it out of their system before they will go into anything else.
That sermonette can be kind of long. How do you make sure it's
a
concise sermonette?
Interrupt. Uh-huh. I don't let them run on all night.
Uh-huh.
They do that before they come, and if they try to go into a filibuster, I had one not long ago, one from the SNL industry who wanted to filibuster, and I stopped him. I cut him off. I do it politely, but we do it.
You started on television before there was videotape, so you couldn't watch a tape-delayed broadcast of your show. You couldn't watch the videotape and see how you were doing. Do you remember the first time you actually watched yourself on videotape, what the experience was like?
I remember I didn't like it. And I didn't like how I looked and sounded, didn't like anything about it. And I've almost never looked at myself since. I'm serious. I mean that. Our Sunday program at 10:30 is done live. At 11:30, we play back the tape to the West Coast and so on. I could easily sit and watch it all. I never, ever watch it.
And why not?
I don't want to look at myself. I don't know why not. Maybe I'm crazy.
But do you ever think, well, you should overcome that feeling so you could see the show and critique it and see if there's anything you wanted to change? Or...
Well, since I was on it, I know what is on the program,
right.
And I know what
okay.
I think was pretty good and what I think was less than good, and so I don't really need to do that to critique it. But as for looking at myself, it really doesn't appeal to me.
David Brinkley recorded in 1989. He died last night at the age of 82 of complications from a fall. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Lost in Translation, a novel about an American woman experiencing Beijing for the first time by Nicole Moniz. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, for Father's Day, some funny, some moving, and some strange stories about fathers told by children who discovered pretty late in life secrets about their fathers' lives. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.